Mes amis, my dear friends, bienvenue, welcome à Général International. Ce soir, il y a beaucoup de monde, there's a lot of people tonight. Vous allez entendre une entrevue menée par nul autre que le grand, the great, directeur du Créole, Daniel Weinstein. En direct de MDG. Et de Halifax, from Nova Scotia, Halifax. We'll all be hearing the voice, la voix de Chris McDonald. And from Washington, D.C., de Washington, mes chers amis, attention, il y aura ce soir aussi avec nous, Lisa Ekenveller. Ça, c'est pour l'entrevue. This is for the interview, my friends. Sur le plancher de la musique, on the music scene, we have directly, en direct, elle nous vient de le grand voyage de la BTB, nous avons Pascal Charlebois. Charles Wood. And from Santa Barbara, California, we have the wonderful, the magnifique, Olivier Dufault. On l'applaudit, on l'applaudit. Il est heureux d'être ici. The Park Extension, from Park Extension, nous avons avec nous, le grand hommage de recevoir Umberto Cirito. Allô, allô, Umberto, allô. Et natif de Québec, mais habitant Montréal, parfois surnommé le Caporal, Vincent Roy! À l'étage supérieur, on the floor up level, nous avons Félix Eugene Samuel Chung Saint-Hilaire avec Leah Weinstock, Benjamin Weinstock et Ryo Chung. Nous vous promettons beaucoup de plaisir. Lots of fun will be with us tonight. Yeah.
De la rue Drolette Street. Petite drôle à cette rue. L'ineffable, l'inénérable Martin Blanchard. Il a 60 ans aujourd'hui. 60 ans. Caporal.
International. 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 International.
L'été est d'habitude une période relativement morte dans les universités et dans les centres de recherche, mais le Créum résiste à cette tendance et nous avons eu le plaisir cet été d'accueillir deux chercheurs, Chris McDonald de St. Mary's à Halifax et Lisa Eckenweiler de l'Université George Mason à Washington, qui sont sur leur départ dans quelques jours et nous avons voulu profiter de leur présence pour leur parler un peu de leur travail et également de la conception qu'ils se font du travail de l'éthicien. So, Chris and Lisa, welcome to Radio Créum.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Chris and Lisa, one of the things that's been particularly interesting for me in having you around is the fact that in many ways, the three of us in our work struggle, think about the same kind of issue. All three of us are trained as philosophers, and yet to a certain degree, our work is probably some of our colleagues view as non-philosophical, almost to the point of suggesting that we might have our place somewhere other than philosophy department. One of the things that I often wonder is the degree to which, as I get more and more enmeshed in issues of practical ethics and really getting my hands dirty on a range of concrete issues, to what degree is the background that I have as a philosopher still really doing work in both the way that I think about issues and the way that I write about issues. So I'd be interested, before we get into talking about what both of you are doing specifically, in getting your thoughts on how you relate sort of formal ethics and philosophy to the very concrete work that you're that you do in your own writing. So I don't know who wants to kick it off.
I'm happy to. I guess I would say that my path to philosophy was rather circuitous in the sense that I wanted to do bioethics. I sort of discovered that as an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it was because of that that I decided to pursue training in philosophy, because all the advice I got was that that was the best sort of background to have. So I went into philosophy thinking this training is going to help me address issues in people's concrete experience. So my sense is that the training is really very useful because you're able to think about the role that ethical theories play in helping to think through certain kinds of problems. And you're also, I think, sort of instilled with an appreciation for the fact that there is this moral pluralism in the world. And so you go into conversations with people, or you go into studying particular problems with the sense that there are multiple perspectives thinking about these things. And so for me, you know, the philosophical training has been useful on those fronts. I mean, it's definitely had its liabilities.
Yeah, I think to see the role that philosophy, you know, can and does play in any applied area, you only need to go to one of the conferences where you see the full range of approaches. I mean, all of the sort of applied areas that the three of us are interested, whether it's business ethics, bioethics, environmental ethics, are fairly deeply multidisciplinary and sometimes interdisciplinary. And if you go to one of the conferences, you immediately, you know, you won't be there very long before you see some stuff that's relatively philosophical. You'll see some other stuff that's relatively empirical. You'll see some stuff that's sort of experiential, people talking about their experiences, either clinical experiences or experiences in the world of business. And it becomes very clear pretty quickly that there are people doing all these different kinds of work. And anybody who, you know, any philosopher who shows up at one of those meetings immediately starts to see, okay, there are people, you know, like the three of us holding down one end of the spectrum and doing, you know, making a different kind of contribution that wouldn't be made if it were, you know, practitioners and clinicians and scholars from disciplines other than philosophy in the room. And I think it becomes really clear quite quickly that we make a particular kind of contribution.
I want to get back to the interdisciplinariness in a minute, but I want to press you both a little bit on something that, that Lisa said, which is the relevance of philosophical theories. Now, when I was a young budding ethicist thinking about these issues thousands and thousands of years ago, you know, I thought that the first thing you had to do was figure out what kind of ethicist you were and make up your mind as to whether you were a Kantian or a consequentialist, utilitarian, or, you know, that vague thing that really nobody's figured out what it means, rather other than that it's not the first two, a virtue ethicist. And then once you've decided that, answers to all the big questions would just roll out. Now, as I've started in my own work grappling with real-world problems, I realize that that's just a completely wrong-headed view of, or at least I think, a completely wrong-headed view of the relationship of theory to practice. I don't know whether I'm a Kantian or a consequentialist anymore. And to some degree, I think it doesn't really matter. But so, you know, that gets us back to the point. What is, you know, if we were to design an ideal curriculum for philosophy students who knew that they wanted to do not philosophy of language or science, but who wanted to use their philosophical training to think about the problems of the world, political, ethical, would we still teach Kant and utilitarianism in the way that we do and present them as these three rival theories that we have to somehow make our minds up about? And if not, what would we do?
Yeah, I think we would still, you know, it's still useful to know where the intellectual roots of these different approaches to solving moral problems comes from. But I actually, in a way, think the problematic is backwards the way it's different from the way I think, because I tend not to think of philosophical theories as a way of solving practical problems. I think of practical problems as a way of doing better at moral theories. So in there's a sense in which, I mean, as a scholar, I mean, I'm interested in helping solve practical problems, and if my work contributes to better solutions in practical domains, that's great. But to a large extent, as a scholar, I think that, you know, I play around in areas like business ethics because I think it's going to help me test philosophical theories better. So in a way, it's the practical things helping do better theory, not using the trying to figure out whether the theories are actually useful at solving practical problems.
Lisa?
Yeah, I sort of approach this with my students by thinking about ethics as some kind of a light. So what I say to them is like, all right, where do you want to shine the moral light? There are these domains of ethical assessment. So do you want to shine it in the direction of consequences? Do you want to shine it in the direction of character? Do you want to shine it in the direction of social and institutional structures? You know, do you want to shine it in the directions of intentions and actions? And so I try to get them to understand that, and here I will tip my hat to a Canadian philosopher, Sue Sherwin, who's written this great book about, it's an article, I'm going to forget the exact title, but she talks about these different approaches to ethical problems as lenses through which we can view the problems. And I found that a particularly helpful metaphor. So light, where do you want to shine it? Lenses, which one are you looking through? And so I think what we get in the end, I don't think it's useful, I guess, to think about these things as rival camps, because ultimately what they do is they generate distinctive kinds of insights, which very often lead people to the same place. They just tend to emphasize different things in getting there. Sometimes they lead us to very different places, but, you know, I think that thinking about them as in competition or as rival is not the best way to think about ethical theory, and maybe even a destructive way to think about it.
Lisa, your work is, and I'll get to the work that you do specifically in a few minutes. But
can we talk about liabilities though of training in philosophy just for two seconds
sure,
at some
of course,
point?
Yeah.
I guess I just want to say that. I think philosophy has a lot of contributions to make to the world, and I think one of the things that we need to do a better job at is training our graduate students to be able to write and speak in ways that are accessible to people. And this is something that I think you, Daniel, have been particularly successful at. I mean, you've got, you know, like fantastic training from some of the best institutions in the world. But at the same time, you can go to audiences who have no philosophers in the room, no philosophical background at all, and speak in very clear and accessible ways. So I find that sometimes the training that we get as graduate students disables us for making really useful contributions in the world. And I think that's something that we really ought to do a better job at. Those of us who want to be particular kinds of philosophers.
Chris mentioned the fact that as we get closer to the real world in our work, and Lisa, you work on issues in health ethics, but in a global context. Chris started off as a bioethicist, is that fair to say, and has been moving gradually towards business ethics. Clearly, the limits of our philosophical training become quite apparent. In my own case, I realized that, you know, to deal well with the issues that I've been interested in, to do with constitutionalism and democratic theory, a little bit of political science would have been a good thing. Law would have been a good thing. Economics would have been a good thing. And so we kind of bone up on these disciplines in a catch-as-catch-can kind of way. You know, reading a couple of books here and there, I'm being a little bit caricaturing a little bit, where, you know, we could have done a full 3-year undergraduate degree in any one of these disciplines. And yet there doesn't seem to be any way around it. We really do need to come to grips with the findings of these different disciplines if we want to address the issues that we're interested in addressing. Is there any way of doing that that isn't dilettantish, that doesn't end up, I mean, we all know how we hate it when people start mouthing off about philosophical theories that they've only just gotten the barest acquaintance with. Are we guilty, almost inevitably, of doing the same thing with law, economics, political science, development studies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Chris?
Hopefully, if we're doing our job right, we're interacting with people who we know more about these topics than we do. I mean, that's one of the virtues of these areas being so interdisciplinary, is that I hope enough about biotechnology and about the relevant science to write about the biotechnology industry, but I also know who's next in the pecking order in terms of, you know, I know which philosopher friends of mine know a little more about the biotech, and for really tough particular questions, I know sort of, you know, which scientists and clinicians are in sort of my you know, friends of friends and colleagues of colleagues sphere that I can call on to, you know, when I need that extra level of sophistication. So, you know, I think our only hope is to know, enough about these other areas to at least understand the problems properly, but also to know who to call on and which people we've met at conferences and so on are going to be able to help
us.
So
the work is necessarily collaborative?
I think that's exactly right. I think that one of the reasons, at least in my case, that I was interested in doing bioethics is that I saw it as a very interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary field. I mean, the first class I ever had in bioethics, it wasn't even a bioethics class, it was ethical and social issues and AIDS. So we had people coming in from, it was led by philosophers, but Dan Wickler was the person in the lead of the class, but we had criminologists, we had sociologists, we had psychologists, we had historians, people from economics, faculty members. So people from a variety of different backgrounds coming in to say, let's think about these questions surrounding this then epidemic. So I think that there's a certain amount of humility that one needs to have if you want to be a certain kind of a philosopher, and that is make contributions to problems in the real world, find good friends who can help you do the work collaboratively.
We're going to hear some more music in a few minutes from General International, but I'd like to ask you a little bit, and, you know, I'm asking you questions that resonate very deeply with me as someone who has philosophical training, is nominally a member of a philosophy department, but spends most of his life in an interdisciplinary research center. How do you, in your own institutions, the institutions that you've dealt with, do you feel as sort of cast-offs from the philosophy department? How do you feel the attitude of your fellow philosophers towards the kind of slightly hybrid, some would say bastardized work that you do? It's not pure philosophy anymore. It's not the sort of thing that would necessarily get published in Mind or the Journal of Philosophy. How do you relate to the discipline?
I've been really fortunate. The institutions where I've worked, first Old Dominion and now George Mason, were very welcoming places to people like me. And now I'm especially lucky because I have a joint appointment, and that suits me really, really well. I mean, apart from the fact that I go to way too many meetings, I see myself as, perhaps true to my last name, as kind of a corner dweller. I like having colleagues in philosophy, and I like having colleagues in health administration and health policy and public health. So I guess I've been really lucky, but I know that that's something that many people struggle with mightily. And in bioethics, people struggle with it in sort of a different way. You have people who are trained in religious studies or in philosophy who are the only kind of creature like that in an academic medical center. So there are a lot of lonely people who are trained like we are, just, you know, lonely for different reasons.
Chris, are you true to your name in any way?
I am a son of Donald at some distance removed. It's true. As for me, my institutional home is a philosophy department. It's the only department I'm a member of. I am sort of in some ways the unusual, you know, the odd man out, but fully accepted and I think reasonably well integrated into my department. Partly because, I mean, my dissertation work, for example, was pure moral theory, and I always saw that as being an important foundation for the kind of work I do. And you know, when I interviewed for my job, I said, well, you know, I'm clearly the applied ethics guy applying for the job, but you know, I'm not going to give you a talk that's applied to ethics. I'm going to show you, you know, it's obvious from my CV that I do all this applied stuff, but here, let me show you how I think, you know, here's the kind of moral theory I do, and here's a little bit of how I think it's integrated. And I sort of felt like I had the burden of proof, and I think that's fair enough, right? I'm the one doing something a little weird in terms of, if you think of the long trajectory of philosophy as a discipline, I'm the one doing something weird, so I feel like it's fair for them to expect me to prove to them that I really am a philosopher and do belong in a philosophy department, and I'm going to be able to train philosophy students and graduate students. So that's been sort of my approach.
And two, you know, I think there is some bitterness, I know, around applied ethics and people who work in applied ethics, if we want to call it that. But I also think that there's a fair amount of appreciation for people doing work in things like business ethics or environmental ethics or bioethics, because philosophy departments, at least in the United States where I come from, are struggling mightily to maintain credibility and to be seen useful, which I think is a tragedy. Because I think that, you know, we all need to be doing philosophy from the age of 3 onwards, which is when we're, I think, probably at our best as philosophers. But I think that a lot of people appreciate, well, you're the most curious anyway, right? But I think a lot of philosophy departments appreciate the fact that their discipline is getting recognition when it was really falling out of favor for many, many years.
I'd like to ask both of you about the work that you're doing, that you've been doing at CREAM this summer, and that you've been doing before that. But before we get into the meat of your work, we're going to hear a little bit more music from General International.
Thank you.
Alors, nous sommes de retour avec Chris McDonald et Lisa Eckenweiler, qui, comme je le disais il y a quelques minutes, ont passé l'été, je l'espère, de manière productive au Créum. So, Lisa, you've been obviously busy working away, greatly helped by the fact that we've had a less than optimal summer here in Montreal this year. It's been easier probably staying inside and being industrious than it might have been if Montreal had been up to its usual summer standards. Tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing and about your work in general.
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a less than optimal time in Montreal during the summer. That's so true. Having said that, I have been at Créum under the generous hosting of Daniel and Martin, working on a book that's tentatively entitled Caregiving in the Context of Globalization Toward Transnational Justice. I'm working on it with Johns Hopkins. And my mission in the book really is to look at issues from the perspective of the United States having to do with caregiving, in particular caregiving for the elderly. So long-term care is really the focus. And it's sort of a two-part project. There's the first part, which is really an epistemological effort, where what I'm arguing for is taking an ecological perspective to think about the landscape of caregiving. So we usually think about ecology as having to do with the study of patterns of nature, for instance, how those patterns come to be, how they change in space and time, why some are more fragile than others. And what I want to suggest in the first part of the book is that we can take an ecological perspective, not just to think about the relationships between things like wind and water and soil and human and animal susceptibilities, but also to think about the relationships that make up the landscape of caregiving. And by that, I mean a couple of things: relationships between people and relationships between policies. So in terms of relationships between people, I'm interested in looking at the relationships between, say, people in need of long-term care, both in the United States and affluent countries, but particularly the U.S., because I have to set the parameters somehow, and people in the Global South. Relationships between those people in need of care and their caregivers, both family caregivers and paid caregivers, and relationships between caregivers who are native to the United States and those who migrate from the Global South. And I'm also interested in taking this approach, as I said, by in terms of looking at relationships among policies, in particular economic policy, labor policy, health policy, and immigration policy. And in taking that approach, what I hope to do is describe the ways in which this configuration of policies, they're really promulgated by governments as well as other kinds of agents like the for-profit sector, transnational corporations, for instance, and international lending bodies, end up contributing to injustices against these different groups of people. So the second part of the book has to do with looking at a conception of transnational justice that'll help address those problems. And there, what I'm working with at the moment is what's known as a social connection model of responsibility, which says that the people who contribute or who participate in the processes, the social processes that contribute to the injustices, have obligations to help remedy those injustices. So that means that governments have certain kinds of obligations to these groups of people. The for-profit sector has obligations to these different groups of people, and international lending bodies have obligations to these groups of people.
Sounds like a fascinating project. When you describe the first part of the book, that sounded like enough for a book in and of itself. A very ambitious. I'm curious. You said you're publishing with Johns Hopkins. Are you? Clearly, this is a book that needs to be read, that should be read by people outside of the academy as well, of course, as our fellow academics. Have you had success? Are you making the connections that will lead to the book being read? Is there an uptake in the United States to sort of ideas like the ones that you are suggesting finding their way, perhaps slowly, indirectly, and in a kind of a viral way outside of the academy and into the body politic?
Yeah, I have met with some success on that front. I mean, I certainly had to make an argument to the publisher that this was going to be of interest to people outside the bioethics readership. And my experience during my sabbatical, which was in Washington before I actually lived there, was at the Center for American Progress, which is sort of a think tank in D.C. And there, my ideas were very warmly received by the policy community. They were less interested in the issue of global health disparities, right, which is really part of what motivates this book. They're very interested in issues around policy for long-term care, given the fact that there's this burgeoning aging population in the United States, as well as many other places in the world. And they were also interested in the book, or the project, I should say, because we have this tremendous shortage of care workers. And by that, I mean nurses and also direct care workers, like nurses' aides, home health aides, home care workers. And one of the ways that we deal with that is by importing, if you will, women from the global south. I mean, it's true for physicians as well, right? But my focus is on other kinds of care workers. And so they were interested in thinking about how we might address that problem. So they didn't really see it in terms of justice issues, right, which is the lens through which I'm seeing it. But they saw the problems as ones that were quite relevant. And again, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of accessibility of philosophy to the general public. I picked this place to do my sabbatical because I wanted to learn more about how to write for a policy audience. And I have to say, it was a really difficult process for me because I had this paper, which I thought was a beautiful paper, and the editing team basically eviscerated it and broke it down into these sort of chewable bits for a Capitol Hill audience. So it was a little frustrating, but on the other hand, there was some uptake. Have I seen legislation around my ideas? Well, no, not yet, but you know, I'm just getting started.
Well, the transnational migration of care workers is an absolutely fascinating and huge topic. One of the abiding images that will stay with me until I die, I think, is spending time in Hong Kong and on a Sunday walking out into the central square of Hong Kong and seeing what seemed like several thousand Filipina women who get their one day off on Sunday and who all congregate in this one place. And it was oceans of people. And you have to ask yourself what impact the fact that they are there in Hong Kong has upon there. Clearly their families being left behind and all kinds of impacts. Well, Chris, from an ecological conception of policies and people around health to ethics of the biotech industry, a stretch, mm-hmm. perhaps not that much of a stretch?
Probably it's probably not that much of a stretch. If I were still doing some of the same kinds of ecological computer modeling that I did as a grad student, it would probably be much less of a stretch, even though it's not the sort of methodological approach I'm taking now. My project for the summer and into the fall is also a book project, tentatively titled Biotech Ethics. Biotech Ethics, Responsible Commerce in Cutting-Edge Science. So basically, it's a book on business ethics focusing on the biotechnology industry. Actually, I've sort of pitched it as having, there are two different ways you could look at this project. It's either a business ethics book that takes the biotechnology industry as a kind of extended case study, or it's a book about biotechnology ethics, but looked at through the lens of business ethics. So, you know, biotechnology has been front page news at least since sort of the late 90s when Dolly the sheep was cloned and the phone started ringing off the hook at ethics centers across the world. But by and large, you know, the vast majority of the work that's been done on ethics related to biotech has either been in the world of healthcare ethics and healthcare policy on the one hand, or in the world of environmental ethics. And sort of my sales pitch is that as biotech starts moving from the lab into the marketplace, commercial questions come to the fore. And we start to have questions like, you know, is it okay to market genetic tests directly to the public? And if you're going to do that, how do you do that responsibly? How should companies price what they call the new biologics, which is sort of the new categories of biotech-derived pharmaceuticals, some of which are phenomenally expensive in the tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars per patient. So my question really is specifically my interest is specifically in corporate decision making, business decision making, how it is that you go about conducting commerce in a responsible way when you really are, on the cutting edge of science, playing with the building blocks of life.
I'll ask you a very similar question to the question I asked Lisa. If you could impose upon a certain group of people that they read your book, other than the people in our industry, in our discipline, who has to be reading this book?
My ambition is that it be a very broadly readable book. I mean, one of the challenges, indeed, is that I'm trying to put enough science in it so that scientists won't, think I'm clueless, and enough economics in it so that the world of business won't think I'm clueless, and enough philosophy so that my philosophical colleagues will respect the work. But I guess if I had to pick one particular audience, I think it would have to be sort of the CEOs of the 100 biggest biotech companies. They're the closest thing I've got to a real audience, and my attempt as an applied ethicist here is to say, look, here's a structured way of thinking about the ethical problems that you face. Here's why, here's an approach that should pose at least as a partial remedy to the idea that many people in the corporate world have, which is that as soon as someone mentions the E word, ethics, that it's because there's a scandal, it's because someone did something bad, it's because, it's a conversation we don't want to have. And I want to be able to talk about ethics in the commercial world in an approachable enough way, and in a way that takes appropriate stock of the realities of the world of business, so that people in industry can say, ah, yes, this actually makes some sense. I can integrate this into my strategic decision-making and into my marketing decisions.
And have you had my own experience in trying to get uptake from the non-academic audience with my ideas is very often the following. Some group of people will decide, we really have to take a step back and think about the ethics of this particular area of policy, for public policy, for example, usually because there's been some kind of a scandal, some kind of an issue that the media have picked up on, and they will retreat somewhere, usually away from where they work. There'll be some kind of policy retreat out in the countryside, to which I'll be invited, which is great because I get to go to nice places in the countryside rather than visiting them in their offices. We have this golden moment together. We chat. They nod their heads, pat me on the back at the end and say, I wish that we could have the luxury of being able to think about these deep topics But then they go back to their offices, and I get the feeling that this golden moment has evaporated from memory almost the next day. How do we work towards, and the question is really for both of you, how do we work towards having a more durable impact in a way, and giving rise to a conception of ethics as something that isn't a sort of outside, something that exists outside the practice of business, outside the practice of policymaking, an area of like health, but something that really is part of the everyday, part of the workaday. Any thoughts?
Yeah, this is something I really struggle with, and this is sort of the one of the things I take as being the next challenge. Now that I've made a reasonable start to an academic career and have published a bit, got tenure, things like that, I sort of feel like the next 10 years I have to sort of figure out how to do that, what the granting councils call knowledge translation. And I had a rather humbling moment at a conference where there were at a conference on biotechnology and social issues, and one of the speakers was the head of a mid-sized biotech company, and I said to him, and he was talking about knowledge translation and about getting stuff from university labs out into the commercial world, and I asked him a question afterwards. I said, well, I'm a philosopher. I generate knowledge, but it's a different kind. It's about best practices ethically speaking in business. How do I translate my knowledge into your world? And he said something very simple and humbling. He said, well, you could try maybe publishing something somewhere I would read it, like Pharmaceutical Executive magazine. Stop publishing in, those, unknown, unread philosophical journals that you've been focusing on, and publish somewhere where I'd actually have a chance of reading it. And I thought that was actually such a plain and simple prescription, if you'll pardon the reference, that it was actually quite humbling.
That's exactly what I would say too. I think, and again, this goes back to the writing and speaking accessibly problem, and also the structure of reward in academia, right? It's really difficult for people in academic careers to publish in popular places because they don't get credit for it. It's not seen as doing serious work. But if you really do want to make a difference for particular audiences, that's exactly where you have to publish. And it takes some time to be able to translate your ideas from articles that other people would see as being sort of on steroids into 200-word, 300-word columns. But I think that's exactly the sort of thing we need to be doing. And I also think it's really important to try to cultivate friends outside academia. So you go to parties, you go to other kinds of gatherings where you just have conversations very informally with people about your ideas. And I think about this in a lot of the same way I think about teaching. I think about it as gardening. It's like planting seeds. You cast them out and you really don't know where they're going to spring up. They may not spring up before your eyes. It may happen a lot later. So you never really know when you have an impact, but I think we very often do, even when we don't see it. And I also think that as people in ethics, it's important to get away from what academia sort of trains us to do, and that's think about our individual contribution and think about ourselves as being part of something much bigger. And that's kind of very slow, sometimes glacial-paced change in society.
You mentioned the structure of academic reward and the fact that we need, even beyond tenure, in order to continue to maintain our credibility, we need to get our one or two or however many pieces a year in the well-respected journals in order to keep our academic capital alive in our home departments and indeed in our universities. All the while knowing that it might not be the article published in Ethics or the Journal of Political Philosophy or whatever that is really going to be doing the work that we want to be doing. At the same time, there's really something very difficult about doing the sort of thing that Chris mentioned, which is making oneself readable to people who don't share the vocabulary or the way of understanding or constructing problems. You may know I've been working a little bit in the area of philosophy of education and childhood, and submitted at the request of an editor an article for an education journal, which I was very proud of. And I got the referee's reports back, and they were very happy that I'd submitted the article and are obviously going to accept it. But as I was going through the comments, it became clear to me that they had, at some very deep level, no idea what I was talking about. And it was also a very humbling moment, even though the article will end up being published, because I realized that I'd failed in translating my discourse into a discourse that was usable by people who are really education administrators and professionals at the university level. But the question that I want to perhaps end this could we go on for hours. There are a lot of things that we share in terms of our concerns. Let me ask you a provocative question, and I ask it as a question that a little devil asks me sometimes. I'm waving at the left side of my head for people who are listening to us on radio.
Sinistre.
Is the sort of thing, you talked about planting seeds, and some of those seeds will do whatever seeds do, germinate, and some won't. Would our germination ratio be higher if we were situated somewhere other than universities? Does it behoove us, as it were? Is this the best place that we could be, as it were, academically based philosophers trying to, from time to time, throw some seeds over into the garden next door in order, abusing this metaphor to within an inch of its life?
That's obviously a really hard question to answer, right? Because how do you know? But I think we're really privileged because we get to do a variety of different things. I mean, we may not have a lot of power, economic power, social power in the sense of recognition in the society, at least given the way academia is increasingly viewed. But we have tremendous opportunity, and it doesn't just have to do with our writing and our speaking, but it has to do with our teaching. Not very many people get three fronts, right, that they get to work on. So we get to teach, we get to write and speak, and we get to do service work of various kinds. So, you know, we have three different ways in which we can make contributions. I'm not sure other people can say that. I don't know. I've never done anything else, but I feel pretty privileged.
Yeah, I'm not clear if it weren't the university, I'm not sure who else would have us. I mean, I mean that's not entirely true. I know people, you know, I think we probably all do. I know people with PhDs from the humanities who work in hospital settings, and I know people with PhDs indeed in philosophy, who work in corporate settings, but they don't get to do the same. They don't get to have the same kind of fun I do, for one thing, and they don't get to. They don't have the sort of freedom to explore and, to, as Lisa says, to toss out these seeds and see what germinates. So frankly, yeah, I it's pretty hard to imagine another setting that would allow us the sort of the freedom of thought and exploration that the university setting allows us. And we have, I mean, and I think if we're going to have an impact on those other areas, it's by sort of visiting them. It's by either by visiting them physically or visiting them by communication. I mean, this is why I write a blog, right? This is because that, you know, I want to be able to reach into those other audiences without necessarily having to work in those other kinds of institutions.
You both, it's not something that's visible, obviously, since this is radio, a medium which is very flattering to me, but I'm substantially older than both of you. But you brought up the issue of teaching, Lisa, which I think is a very important one. It is the case that every year in, year out, we get to see, talk to, and hopefully influence some dozens, hundreds of young people who, many of them, will go on to do something other than academia, most of them actually. Have you, at this very early stage in your careers, been able to sort of track some of your students who've gone out into the world and who've come back and said, you know, Professor McDonald, Professor Reckenweiler, had it not been for your class, I would not have done this one thing, which you then recognize as being a pretty good thing to have happened?
Well, I've had those moments in certainly in small ways and even in quite unexpected ways just within the university setting. I've had, you know, students, you know, a very smart sociology major came to me and said, you know, it was, you know, your critical thinking class when you taught me how to structure an argument in a way that really drew out what the premises of my argument was and how they led to the conclusion, that really, really helped me in writing, you know, papers in my other classes. And then I guess in terms of practical impact in the world, I just a couple of years ago supervised my first MA student, and she is now, you know, employed she now works for an organization that is making excellent use of her training in sort of issues around corporate social responsibility, and she's actually out there advising companies and doing good things.
Well, I get really good feedback usually from a small group of students at the end of every semester about how, you know, this is the different kind of class than I've ever had. This has changed the way I think about a whole variety of things. But I've been really lucky just in this last year. I've had a couple of cases of former students who've come back to me and said, because of your class, I'm pursuing this particular degree in this particular way. So I just had a student who's going to do international relations. And she says she, you know, thinks about, you know, this from an ethical perspective on a daily basis. I have another student who just graduated with his master's degree in science, who just wrote me a couple of weeks ago after defending his thesis and said that, you know, feminist epistemology changed his life. And he's a guy who's doing work in ecological engineering. So I think most of them don't ever let us know that it's made a difference. And of course, there are some of them, you know, who loathe and despise us. But I think on the whole, we provide a really different kind of experience for students. And I think we have impacts on their lives, which we don't necessarily see.
I'll end with my favorite anecdote in this respect. I taught and still teach a medical ethics course. And the first year that I taught it, a student that took it the first year that I taught it bumped into her years later on the street, and she came up to me and was very effusive in a way that was very gratifying, telling me how much she enjoyed the course and how important it was for her and continued to be for her, and started getting carried away a little bit and saying that she hoped that one day she'd be able to help me in the way that I had helped her. And I asked her, what specialty she'd gone on to practice, and she said cardiology, and my jaw dropped, and I don't think she really understood why it wasn't necessarily a good thing to be saying to someone that as a cardiologist she really hoped that she'd be able to help me. But one takes what one can get. Lisa, Chris, thank you very much for having taken the time to talk to us. Thank you very much for having spent the time gracing our offices and corridors at CREUM. And before we end the show, we will listen to General International one more time. Thank you.
quiet, but mighty. I did feel the for the million.